And we are now recording, so that's brilliant. Okay, let's get straight into it. Hello, everyone. Welcome back to another episode of the Breaking Boy podcast. Today, we're here with Dr. Chase Bradford, who is an MD, which I'm pretty sure in the UK is a GP, what we would call a GP, general practitioner, and also has trained in psychiatry as well. And we're going to have a talk about therapy, him. And I've got a load of questions I'm looking at right now that I can't wait to ask him. So let's get straight into it. How are you doing, Chase, this morning?
I'm doing fantastic, Ollie. Thank you so much for having me. Appreciate what you're doing. And these are conversations that we need to have.
Absolutely, we need to have them. So let's give the people a bit of a background of you and what got you to this point that you are now.
Sure. So I'll be honest. You know, I never thought I'd be working in the field of mental health when I was younger. I always knew I wanted to go into medicine. I always knew I wanted to be a physician. I'm the first in my family, so I don't really know where that ambition came from. Maybe it was a seed implanted by my mother. Yeah. But I went to undergrad here in America. It's a little different. You do 4 years of your pre-med undergrad, then you go to medical school. And I went to the University of Massachusetts, which is where I'm from, New England, Massachusetts. Went to a fantastic program. And I went to medical school with the intention of going into surgery. That was the thing that really captivated me. And I worked in an operating room for 2 years before medical school as part of my exposure experience, which is kind of commonplace now in America. You can't just apply right in. It's rare to do that. So I'll kind of cut out most of the fluff and just get to some of the more important points of how I transitioned from being all about surgical procedure and medicine to more of this mental health, you know, healing, emotional trauma, all that. So somewhere in the middle of my training, usually in the third year for most students, you start doing rotations. And that's when you get exposed to all of the specialties in medicine, which is great. Because again, mental health was not on my radar, mostly because I had never been exposed to it. My very first rotation was working with, we'll just say the most sick, the most mentally ill children in the Commonwealth of Massachusetts. It's sort of the end of the line terminal facility, for these folks, for these kids who just, you know, really have serious challenges and need a lot of support and really can't function at home in a normal school, in normal society, because there's a risk of some sort. So that was just an amazing experience. I really loved working with the young kids, seeing them actually heal, you know, being able to, in many ways impact someone's life in such a profound way. You know, it wasn't just, having a therapy session, giving them medication, seeing them walk out your door. Like you work with these kids, day in, day out over, months. So that sort of planted the seed, maybe mental health might be for me. And the moment when I knew mental health was my calling, I was later in that clinical year of medical school, I was in my surgery rotation where I'm like, hey, this is my jam. I'm gonna just, you know, really take it all in and shine and move forward. I was in a vascular surgery, and I believe we were doing amputation of the toe. And I was, you know, sitting there scrubbed in the surgical field, talking with the surgeon, someone I actually had known before medical school, and he told me something because I guess he had this question in his mind when he was in my shoes, and he really liked mental health. He loved psychiatry, and he was between psychiatry and surgery, and you know we were talking about that sort of decision, and he told me, he goes, Chase, you know, I end up choosing the less invasive specialty, meaning surgery. And that just totally hit me, right? I mean, here we are literally removing the toe of a person from vascular disease. And he felt that that was less invasive than the work we do in mental health. And I was sold from there. So fast forward to where I am here. And my goal is just to have these conversations with folks like you, Ollie, through social media, all these other platforms, because mental health is something that we don't prioritize enough, certainly not in America. I suspect that's the same in the UK. We see mental illness on the rise, and you know, these are difficult conversations to have, but we need to have them to see how we can start healing.
Absolutely. No, that's brilliant. I love the, that is a incredible insight from that guy, the less invasive form of medicine. I think that's really, really, really good. So I had a look at your website, and there's a list of complicated words here that I've copied and pasted, and it says that you are an apathetic medicine? Right at the beginning.
Well, certainly not apathetic.
No, it's not apathetic. No, not apathetic. It's a word I've never heard of. Do you know what? It doesn't matter. We'll move on. You've got functional, osteopathic, naturopathic, and nutritionist. And these are the doctrines of medicine that you affiliated with yourself with in this sort of new endeavor that you've taken on the mental health world. Why those?
Right. So the list you're speaking of, one of the things that I think is unique to my approach to mental health is that it takes into consideration the traditional medical approach. We call it allopathic medicine. That's what an NCE stands for. It means you've been
treating allopathic.
Allopathic. Okay.
That was the word.
I'm sure there's an eloquent description of what allopathic medicine is, but for all intents and purposes, let's just say it's the traditional route.
Perfect.
And that's what most of the physicians practicing in America are trained in, allopathic medicine. It has its shortcomings, and that's where these other fields, I think, have a lot of benefit to at least being aware of them. Things like functional medicine, osteopathic medicine, diet, nutrition, other holistic measures, alternative medicine, chiropractic. There's a whole slew of other types of approaches to health that are deliberately cut out of the allopathic program. So when you go through your medical training, you get, just a couple of seminars on nutrition, and it doesn't take much practical knowledge to recognize that nutrition is such a huge determinant of one's health, both physical and mental. So when I eventually sort of looked to the other side and realized there's this whole world of healing that I'm not aware of, I don't really know that much about, I needed to go figure that out. So there was about a year there where I spent a lot of time working with professionals in all of these domains, functional, osteopathic, naturopathic, et cetera, et cetera. And my whole world was just opened up. You see ways to handle, and again, I'm coming from a mental health perspective, you see ways to manage things like depression, anxiety, without medications. And that's not to say that there's no place for medications. I think there absolutely is. But the in my mind, one of the downfalls of allopathic medicine is the over-reliance on pharmaceuticals. And I think, it working with patients in the traditional setting, you recognize right away that a lot of patients are harmed by pharmaceutical use. There's very few medications, if any, that are truly safe, that are truly benign. They all have side effects. They all have some level of dependency, tolerance, where, you know, the effect you once had with it can no longer be achieved at the same dose. You have to start increasing the dose and higher to the point where now you start having greater likelihoods of side effects, very undesirable consequences. So I think one of the reasons for expanding my horizons within this field of healing is that I was getting really frustrated primarily using medications to treat mental anguish. And I think now there's a whole domain. Therapy is also within the allopathic umbrella. And I think therapy is a fantastic way to handle mental illness. But I think you really need to incorporate all of these ideas because every person is different. Every patient has unique needs, unique life circumstances. And a medication is not a one-size-fits-all.
No, it's not. And I think one of the things that I recommend to people, if I'm talking to someone who's struggling, is try and take your life back to basics and look at the fundamental things that you do on a daily basis. And, you know, the things that we do every day repeatedly, they become trivialized to some degree because we think that they're meaningless because we do them every day, but actually they're incredibly important. So look at your diet, look at your sleep, control what you possibly can to the maximum degree. I think you put a thing up on your Instagram or something about some guy talking about the power of that control, that is the necessity of controlling as much as you can to eliminate the chaotic element of the external world, and hopefully that can reflect back into the internal world. But you're absolutely right. I'm trained in something called EFT. Have you heard of EFT? So it's emotional freedom technique. So it's basically acupressure. No, acupuncture, but it's acupressure. So it's tapping on different parts of the body. And I think you're spot on the over-reliance on pharmaceuticals, and also the over-reliance on, especially with, you know, a practice like CBT, the over-reliance on the conscious mind is something like CBT, and how the subconscious mind is even more important than the conscious mind, and how there's a lacking of a bodily somatic approach when you engage in something like CBT. So I think Western medication and therapy has got a lot of...
Well, one of the things about CBT that you brought it up, Ollie, is that we think, you know, CBT is sort of the gold standard when it comes to... Yeah. Your sort of jack of all trades, therapeutic approach to manage mental anguish. One of the things we know about people who have had successful bouts with CBT is that one of the common things that they report is that they had a positive relationship with that therapist, which, you know, I mean, there's a lot of confounding variables here, but what that tells me is you take someone who is isolated with their thoughts. You take someone who feels like they're misunderstood. They have no social network. They have they're trying to navigate their anguish on their own, and you expose them to someone who cares, someone who makes that connection. That right there might be a huge amount of the legwork in itself. You know, the CBT tactics I think can be helpful, but when it comes to therapy, just being present with someone, having an empathic clinician just listening to you, organizing your thoughts is absolutely invaluable. Which, when you talk about the basics, Ollie, feeling socially disconnected, feeling isolated, I think is one of the key components why mental illness is seeing such a dramatic rise, because that's what our society has sort of become.
Why do you think it's become that?
So there's a number of reasons. I think one of the chief among them is just our transition from, I would call it the real space into the virtual space.
Yeah.
Technology integration is really changing everything about the way we connect with people. And you know, you look at the communities that no longer exist, right? People have withdrawn from the social square, as they call it, in withdrawn into this virtual space, your social media. I mean, even right now, Ollie, it's great that we have the capacity to speak virtually halfway across the world. But man, wouldn't this be even better if we were together in the same room?
Yeah, it would be. But if you want to pay for a flight out to South Carolina, I'm more than happy to oblige. That would be brilliant. One day we'll be there. I think that notion of social media in the virtual world really, really crops up. And I think there's even a deeper level to it, in the sense of not only are we superficially, so much of our lives is within technology, but I feel that has a deeper impact on our subconscious and how we're, I don't know, I haven't quite formulated it perfectly, the idea, but we're disconnected, and that affects us in a conscious sense and also a subconscious sense, and I haven't quite worked it out, but there's, you know, like everything, there's so much more to the the localized impact of something, there's all these other things that happen alongside it, and it's really complicated. So I guess you've kind of already, sorry, were you going to say something?
Well, to that point, Ollie, we're all just kind of theorizing, seeing what sticks on the drawing board here, but
absolutely.
The way you socialize with someone virtually is very different than the way you socialize with them in person. And one of the functions of in-person socialization is to get feedback, right? So, let's say, you are someone who has an idea and, you're with a group of friends and you're speaking, and it's very clear that this idea is harmful, it's toxic. I don't know. But the expectation is your peer network is going to provide you feedback. Like, hey, listen, Chase, what you're saying is kind of, you should kind of tone it down a bit, right? Like, they're going to give you gentle, positive feedback so that you can better orient the way you operate in the world. But in this virtual space, I mean, the toxicity is limitless. You see how people hide behind an avatar and attack others on social media, which is, again, sort of the new social square, the new social square. They'll say things that they would never say in person, right?
Yeah.
Because it comes off as too aggressive. It comes off as just too toxic. And instead of getting that gentle feedback to move you into the direction you need to go to operate optimally, I think people are becoming so taken back by this level of hate or anger or fear that they're not getting that positive feedback orientation that they need to organize their thoughts adequately in the world.
Absolutely. I was watching a podcast with Jordan Peterson, big up JP. I don't know if you've heard of him. Have you heard of him? Yeah. And he...
Oh, he's brilliant.
He's brilliant. Yeah, he's brilliant. And he was talking about how... So sex, as in the act of sex, evolved to as a defense mechanism against parasites. And because what parasites do is they mimic the genetic code of a host so that they can more easily, I guess, attach themselves and infect. And what sex does is it takes two differing entities and creates something that is new and has a different genetic code. So, and I sort of looked that to the, I extrapolated that out to the notion of ideas and how what me and you are doing right now, and the whole point of something like free speech, and what from a mythological perspective, maybe his religious perspective, is called the logos, whatever. It is the action of creating something new out of refreshing things continuously. And that's why conversation and open dialogue is so important, and that's akin to and you're right. And another thing which he said is how technology isn't our defense mechanisms against parasites don't translate into technology. We've got no,
that's right,
your people are constantly getting bombarded with scams, and my grandma is always getting phone calls from scam artists, and you've got the internet trolls, and you've got all these things going on at the moment that the technological world is, it's the Wild West, isn't it? Really, we've created a virtual Wild West that we're all dipping in and out of, and this is why sort of partisan political beliefs. I don't want to get political because there's far more important things to talk about, but the fact that nowadays people are worried and overwhelmed with their own political ideologies, and how there's no, the religious, the political has become the religious. So if you disagree with people politically, you're now disagreeing them from a metaphysical and far more deeper level than it should be. And that's causing all sorts of problems. But yeah, we'll see where that ends, as we will see where a lot of things will end. We won't see where it ends. But
I take it the political dramatic landscape is pretty similar in the UK as it is over here in the US.
It's not as intense, no. Like, you guys are really... I did a podcast the other day, and I was like, The UK is probably 5 years in the tracks of the US, but no, you guys are very, very polarized. And how do you go about the process of giving someone a second opinion, especially around sensitive topics? And how do you manage their expectations and not undermine the diagnosis or opinions of the previous practitioner? Did you get that?
That's right.
A complicated question.
Yes, sir. No, it's a great question. So what we see is that people often have a lot of questions about diagnoses and about treatment. And one of the reasons is because in the traditional allopathic sort of mindset, you sort of match the treatment with the diagnosis. Like you have sort of this catalog of algorithmic best practices. So if you have bipolar disorder, you're very likely going to presumably benefit from a mood stabilizer, plus or minus a couple other agents as well. So, you know, that happens to a lot of folks. They go and they interface with traditional psychiatry. They may get a diagnosis on the very first encounter, or it might take a while. Hopefully it takes a while, right? Because to provide someone, yeah, you know, to get a bona fide diagnosis that they feel is irrefutable, I mean, that takes years, if ever it can be achieved. Because the DSM is really just a pattern recognition book. It really doesn't speak to the individual challenges of the person. It just provides sort of a framework. And I think there's another shortcoming of the traditional approach. But so let's take this bipolar example. So, you know, bipolar disorder type 2 is one of the most commonly misdiagnosed illnesses in modern mental health, particularly among women. So, you know, what they experience is a lot of mood dysregulation. They have the highs and lows. It may not be so severe, you know, full-blown mania where they have the bipolar 1, but so they kind of get this bipolar 2, which is a more milder version of bipolar 1. And so they may get put on medications like mood stabilizers. And, you know, mood stabilizers, is, if you may or may not be aware, Ollie, a lot of them come with teratogenic effects, which means, you know, you really don't want to use them during pregnancy because of fetal development. So, I mean, again, you have women who are getting this diagnosis in this example, and they're on these medications, and, you know, they're not really helping. And maybe they have some side effects, and maybe they're entering a period of their life where they want to have children. And they're really not trying to navigate this because maybe their psychiatrist, clinician feels very strongly they need to stay on this. This diagnosis makes the most sense given your picture. And they just want really a second opinion. So you can have someone like me come in as a sort of a consultant, and our relationship can be sort of a one-time ad hoc thing. It can be something more extensive, more longitudinal. And really, it's to hear your story with a fresh set of eyes and ears. Even better if the consultant has training outside of the traditional model. Again, because most of the clinicians they're working with have a very linear mindset. And again, it's very algorithmic-based medicine. So if you can have someone who has understanding, and I don't claim to be an expert of functional medicine, of nutrition, but I have an awareness that I think is far more than what is certainly taught in allopathic training.
Yeah, of course.
You can look at things from different perspectives, and you can certainly think of conservative strategies that might be beneficial. One of the limitations of being a consultant is I'm meeting someone sort of in the middle of their journey. There's been a lot of legwork done prior to me, and there'll be far more after my encounter. And my job is to make sense of that. And managing expectations, as you mentioned, Ollie, is key. If I meet someone for an hour, I mean, we're really just scratching the surface, because we would dive deep into some areas that may have been ignored entirely in their interfacing with mental health. Things deep in the social history, like relationships, family structure, community, spiritual wellness, you know, nutrition, movement, all of that. And that, you know, just covering one of those domains could take 30 minutes to an hour. So it's sort of a balance between, do we want to cover as much as we can superficially, or take one element that we think is going to be the most impactful and dive deep into it? And this may happen over multiple sessions, right? One of the, again, limitations is I'm not taking a person under my care directly. I don't make that claim. I think it is really key that a patient stays with their primary physician. And what they do is maybe they bring new tools to that relationship to make that clinical relationship work more optimally. And I think one of the reasons patients feel like they need a second opinion is they don't feel like their voices can be heard from their primary psychiatrist clinician. They don't know how to advocate for themselves. They don't know how to, they may be able to research things, but they don't know how to present it in a way that may be receptive to their clinician. So that might be one of the functions I provide, is to show a patient how to advocate for themselves. Let's say they want to come off medications, but their provider feels strongly that they should stay on them. How do you navigate that conversation? How do you employ conservative non-medication strategies to try to see if this works? What would be the next step? Would we then start tapering off medication if, say, my anxiety improved by 50% by making these three lifestyle modifications? And lo and behold, sometimes that's actually achievable, because medications aren't fixing the root of the illness. They're only masking them.
Absolutely, yeah. I think that's a really powerful thing that you do, Chase, in the sense that you provide a sidestep perspective from what they've heard, and you'll be able to articulate possibly some of their difficulties and, I suppose, desires for their future pharmaceutical medication use and for their general well-being. So that's, I like that second opinion, because I suppose, I mean, I'm very, very ignorant to American healthcare. Obviously, in the UK, we've got the NHS, which is the National Health Service. So everyone gets access to free healthcare, and you sign up with a GP practice. And what is the American healthcare system like, in your opinion? And how is it? I know it's a weird question.
It's challenging. One, because it's all I know, right? I've never worked or socialized medicine place. What I do know is that people come to America for their healthcare, or at least they historically did. I don't know if I think medicine is sort of crumbling at the foundation as it stands today. I don't think we're the medical powerhouse we once were, say, a decade ago. And there's a number
in the U.S. that, but, or in general.
In the U.S. You know, you think of some of the finest medical centers in the world, you know, some of the ones in Boston, New York, John Hopkins, et cetera. You know, people will fly all across the world to be seen here. And oftentimes they'll be paying out of pocket, right? So I think what we're seeing in America is we're seeing sort of somewhat of an exodus of patients outside, leaving the traditional medical model. They're sick of paying high insurance premiums. They're sick of getting care that leaves them feeling dissatisfied. A lot of physicians, like myself, are leaving the traditional medical model and starting practices independently, whether it's direct pay, concierge, et cetera, outside of the insurance model. So for the patients who can afford to make that transition, I think they're finding a lot better care by moving to, again, this sort of parallel system. But the problem is most people can't afford to make that switch, especially if you are someone who is getting like Medicare services. If you're elderly, you have a bunch of comorbidities, a lot of medications, you have a lot of specialists that you see. It's not practical to drop your insurance and try to do all of that in a direct pay model. It's just not. The infrastructure is not there. So for many patients who are ill, who are on the illness track, they're sort of, there really is nowhere for them to go. They're stuck in the system for better or worse, and hopefully for better. But if you are healthy, if you are younger, you have some means, and you are awake to some of the limitations of traditional medicine, by and large, these folks are really starting to step outside of the medical system and look at this parallel system that's being in place.
Yeah. The coming back to technology, the sort of the exodus, no, the genesis of technology and the level of information that you have access to on the internet. I mean, I'm not saying it's all incredibly trustworthy, but you're capable of, because I've had a lot of difficulties with my skin in the past, sort of acne. And the traditional way of looking at things is, you know, you get on antibiotics, you get diagnosed, or you get prescribed some sort of retinol or retinoid or something like that. And then what social media has done is it's allowed us to expand the horizon of possible treatments and the importance of the holistic approach. So going back to all the things that, you know, exactly in the same sense that you've progressed out, and you can listen to stories of people and find what worked for them, what didn't work for them. You can consume information, data, all these things, and you can come up with your own decision, trial and error, and you don't have to follow the path that the NHS in the UK sets you on and says, this is what you need to do, this is what the conditions are. And also, the, you know, as much as I'm not a huge fan of the free market, and I think it's causing a lot of problems, especially in the modern era, but the capacity for entrepreneurs to create, you know, there's so many different, this is specifically with skin, I'm sure there's other things, but like companies out there that, you know, have curated their own means of treatment and natural products, and you can hear about them. You are right, especially with young people. There is kind of a desire, I suppose, for breaking away a little bit from traditional medicine. And, you know, they've gotten a bad rap recently, especially with things like the Purdue opioid crisis and things like that, you know, the pharmaceuticals. Yeah.
Well, Ollie, I suspect it's very similar in the UK when you talk about the medical system that's in place, similar to the US medical system. I think allopathic medicine does a reasonably good job at managing illness. So once you are on an illness tract, they can diagnose it, they can test for it, they can provide a number of pharmaceuticals, and they can make your life better. Maybe not cure it, maybe not rid yourself of that disease burden, but you can certainly prolong your life through those means. But when we talk about younger, healthier people, that's one of the major shortcomings of the traditional system, is that it doesn't really do much to prevent you from entering that illness track. They don't really teach you or empower you how to take control of your health when you're young, when you're healthy, so that as to never need modern medicine. If modern medicine did its job, the vast majority of older adults would not need the high level, specialized, expensive services in their later age. They would be able to grow up, become older, and just be healthier, right? Obviously, there's some level of disease burden that comes with aging, right? But I think that's one of the challenges, is modern medicine is not preventative. It's reactive. In younger, healthier people who are dissatisfied with that model, they want to do everything they can now so that when they're 60 years old, you know, they're not on insulins for, diabetes. They're not taking, you know, blood pressure medication, hypertension, that they have a body that that will bring them all the way to the finish line.
Yeah. And that's very, very true. There's no preventative actions in place necessarily. Sometimes I can get quite conspiratorial, but the degree to which the food that we're eating, the medications that we're exposed to, it's kind of, there's kind of a narrative to some degree, emerging of how much are we being treated from conditions that are a result of our environment, and how, because I'm not sure what it's like in the US, but you read statistics about the food that we eat and the pesticides and things that we're exposed to, and all this links into it links back into pharmaceuticals companies. So it's very complicated to how much we have sort of free agency over our own health and how much we are. But anyway, let's move on. That was really good. I like that, the way you put the young people wanting to prevent preventative act measures is really important. Yeah. Right. So a question on psychopathology in general, psychopath as in dark tetrad, as in
right
pathology of the brain. Because I always get confused, because they're basically the same thing, aren't they? It's like, which one are you talking about? What do you think contributes most to mental illness? Is it a state of like state neuroticism from a Big Five perspective? Is it brain injury? Is it trauma? Is it environment? Is it all these disparately associated variables contributing to a condition? What do you think is the key? Keys.
Yeah. So I think the first thing to do, Ollie, is to distinguish what we're talking about. What is the variable that we're looking at? And that's one of the reasons why I use the term mental anguish as opposed to mental illness. And I deliberately use that term in certain places. Mental illness, when I think of mental illness, I think of very severe psychopathology. I think of the patient who is extremely depressed, may have emergence of psychotic features, maybe they're catatonic. And that is not someone who can navigate conservative measures or behavior modification to fix the problem. Like, there's something seriously fundamentally wrong. It may be in the body. It may not be in the brain. It may not just be a psychiatric process, but that is a severe psychiatric manifestation of illness. When I talk about mental anguish, I'm talking about low-level anxiety, low-level depression, insomnia, fatigue, chronic pain. You think of addiction or the capacity or predisposition to addiction. All of these things that I think are far more salient to the average person, right? Most people are never going to have a full-blown psychotic episode in their life. But most people at some level will experience some mood dysregulation, right? So I think, answering what is the cause of mental anguish versus mental illness? I think what you're asking, Ollie, is mental anguish sort of at large. Why are we seeing more people diagnosed with mood disorders, anxiety disorders, ADHD, all this across the board? I do believe it's multifactorial. I really think trying to find a singular unifying answer is going to be not anyone's best interest here. I think you've already hit on a few of the things, Ollie. We've talked about the disconnected nature of our society. You talked about environmental toxins, whether that's certain ingredients in our food, pesticides used. We talk about politics, right? One of the things that we're seeing, particularly in America, is this incredible divide among people, to the point where they are, and by they, I mean politicians who are pushing ideas as hard as they can on the public, they are fractioning entire families. Mm-hmm. People who they once loved, uncle, aunt, mother, father, may have a different opinion on something. And whereas the perceived disparity of that opinion between you and them was once small and manageable, has sort of become this massive divide that is no longer bridgeable. And so you're seeing families just shatter because of this. I can't tell you how many patients, Ollie, that I've had who say, I've lost loved ones. They didn't die. They didn't commit suicide. They didn't overdose. I've lost them because they don't want anything to do with me. And so what you're seeing here is a mass demoralization syndrome, which is multifactorial, all of these components that would otherwise resemble a healthy mental makeup are being disturbed. They're being totally thrown to the wayside. All the traditions that we followed that would contribute to otherwise, you know, mental health, mental wellness, they're just not there anymore. So again, I think it's multifactorial, but I think the one thing we're seeing is a mass demoralization syndrome. And I suspect that's probably the same over the pond.
Yeah, no, I think that's brilliant. I'd never thought of use the word demoralization, but I think especially young people are more and more demoralized. And as I mentioned earlier, the fact that we're now confusing the political with the religious, I think what we're doing now is I wrote a blog post about it. We're overlaying a morality onto politics and how, you know, and traditionally that's seen as the right being the villains and the left being the heroes. And I suppose maybe 10, 20 years ago, there was slightly more truth of that because the Liberals and Labour Party in the UK were the party of the working class, you know, quote unquote working class. And now, particularly, I think in America, they've been abandoned and now it's become something far more pathological. And I think especially, you know, the statistics for young males are the suicide rates, the dropping at a university, the homelessness, the mental health issues, the loneliness, it's all growing up. And I was going to do a video about this, but I'm going to talk about it now because I think it's absolutely brilliant. It wasn't my idea, but the film The Lion King is a perennial story of, I guess, kind of society, and it's particularly of the patriarchy, I suppose. You've got Mufasa, who is the benevolent king, and then you've got Scar, who is the oppressive patriarch, or the evil uncle, because there are loads of evil uncles throughout pop culture and mythology. And what we're seeing now is we're seeing the feminists and the left are categorizing society as an oppressive patriarchy. So what they're basically is they're ascribing our worlds as though Scar, it's like the end of the film when everything, I don't know if how well you know The Lion King, but it's like at the end of the film when everything's dark and all the animals are dying and there's no food. And they say that is our society with Scar. And there was never a Mufasa. There's no such thing as a benevolent king. It's just Scar's in charge all the time. I'm talking, you know, bear with me. I'm talking metaphorically here, obviously. And when Mufasa dies and Simba says to Scar, "What do I do?" Scar says, "Run away and never come back." In other words, you're a disgrace. And this is what society, I think, is doing to young people, but young men in particular. And they're basically, what they're doing is they're running away and they're retreating to pornography and social media and substance abuse and loneliness. And what's so ironic is the feminists who, in theory, and the leftists who are in theory trying to help young people and help society have now transmuted into that mouthpiece of Scar, who was saying all men are evil, patriarchy is awful, never, no such thing as benevolence, it's just oppression, it's just tyranny, run away and don't try and manifest any ability, because it's just a case of tyrannical oppression. And that's what young people and young men are doing. And that's why I think they're so demoralized, because that is playing itself out on the broader scheme. I don't know. That's quite random, but I think that's quite impressive.
Ollie, I have a question. I have a follow-up.
Yep.
In your example, with Scar being the envious, tyrannical uncle,
yeah,
and let's just say Mufasa didn't have Simba. Let's say Nala was Mufasa's daughter, and there was the only daughter. There was no Simba. There was no son involved.
Yeah.
And after Mufasa dies, Nala being the feminine, what would Scar say to Nala in that same exact position where Nala says, "What do I do?"
I don't know. I mean, I don't think he might not say the same answer to you there. He might say, "Stick around."
I suspect not.
Yeah, and try and
why not be with me? Something like that.
Yeah, be coercive. But you know, that's another thing that we see playing out in The Lion King, the fact that Simba runs away to Pleasure Island with Timon and Pumbaa. So he takes on no responsibility and he's in, you know, pornography, substance abuse, sports, he's in that world. And Nala comes along and says, "What the heck has happened to you? You're supposed to be king." And he goes, "I can't go back. What I've done is so awful." And it's that you know, I'm a big fan of Jungian psychology, the anima and the animus. It's that integration of those two polarities coming together. And it's, you know, he looks to the scene where Simba says, he looks up in the sky and he looks at Mufasa and he says, "I don't know what to do." He says, "You are my son, you are my king." And I think every individual, the individual is that which refreshes the tyrannical aspects of society, and also the, I suppose, the brutish nature of nature, and you know, and what we're doing right now is exactly that exact same manifestation played out. So Lion King's an incredible film. I do a whole podcast on it with someone, because I wasn't around when it was a thing, but I asked my parents and they were like, yeah, it was an absolutely massive thing. I think it blew everything out from a box office perspective until, I guess, Titanic came along a few years later. So, yeah, there's my little Lion King.
Back when Disney was good.
Over. Yeah, exactly. Back when Disney was, yes, 100%. Now, unfortunately.
Well, you know, to that point, Ollie, you know, you talk about that it is, I think you mentioned something, that it is our inherent duty, calling, something like that.
Yes.
To refresh tyrannical structures. And, you know, one of the interesting things, Ollie, is that it takes the masculine sort of anima to do that. And that is, and masculinity is what is cultivated in a good patriarchy. Like,
exactly.
let's not make the overgeneralization that all patriarchies are good. I mean, yeah. I've been in, maybe, let me give an example, Ollie, in medicine. It's very hierarchical. And, you know, you enter as a student, you become a resident, you become an attending, then a senior attending, then a medical director. And that culture is magnified within surgery. Again, remember, my initial interest was surgery. And you should see the way old school surgeons, not all of them, but many old school surgeons would treat their residents, their students, their nurses. I mean, that is an example of, I mean, what, as far as I can say, is a toxic patriarchal structure. But yet the people below them will accept it. They'll be submissive to it because they want to climb the structure to then be that older, seasoned rock star surgeon. That surgery as a whole has sort of been, it's sort of in a renaissance right now, a revolution, I should say, whereas they're trying to break that toxicity down a bit, which I think is a good thing. So, again, there are examples of good patriarchal structures in those that are toxic. But regardless of how you view it, the masculine is cultivated in the patriarchal structure to then overthrow tyranny when it does inevitably take root at the top of a patriarchal structure.
Brilliant, yes. So that's what I suppose that's... So in go back to Lion King, you've got Zazu, who's the king's eyes. He flies above everything and he sees what's going on. And I forgot about this. He has a conversation with Mufasa. He says, "You need to watch Scar because he's up to no good." And Mufasa goes, "No, it's fine." You know, so that the benevolent king is willfully blind and outdated, and the oppressive uncle is trying to take him out. And I think what you just pointed out about the hierarchy is but if you try and destroy the hierarchy, I think the first people to come back are the oppressive uncle, which is what's happened with young men now, which is because masculinity has been destroyed and it's been branded as solely toxic. Someone like Andrew Tate is able to rise to the top because he has the gap that's been created through the condemning of masculinity as a source is been infiltrated by someone like Andrew Tate, who is ironically even more toxic than anyone ever the people were previously ascribed as being toxic. So it's a very complicated thing.
Yeah. You know, it's so dangerous to take a sledgehammer to a stable structure, and whether we describe it as patriarchal or anything, right? If you remove that structure, and you see it all the time, right? Like look in businesses. Let's say, you know, the COO right below the CEO gets cut. All of a sudden, the entire environment of that structure changes. Now all of a sudden you have a vacuum, and everyone sees an opportunity to enter that empty space now, and you start seeing people behave in ways they never obviously would. And so, you know, you just talk about, I think you mentioned the radical feminism trying to just totally, you know, destroy the masculine types, destroy the patriarchy, and what's left in its stead. And I think we're starting to see the consequences of that right now.
Absolutely. Yeah, what rises from the ashes. Because it from a religious
perspective... It's not always better.
No, it's not always better. No, and from a religious perspective, I don't know if you're religious, if we can talk about that, if it's something you're interested in, but...
Sure.
In the book, the book, I'm not sure what it is, but when Moses, I think it's Moses, I should do my research better before I tell that story, but when Moses leads the Israelites out from the being slaves from the Egyptians, they don't immediately reach the promised land. They reach the desert. So what that's trying to say is that a breakdown of tyranny isn't paradise. It's a desert. In other words, it's a place where you're probably going to die, and it's a place of lacking of everything. And then eventually you could reach a promised land. But I think that's why people are so attached to their ideologies and things, because if you rip that tyranny, because it is a tyranny, if you're incredibly attached to something, you rip that away from someone, they're no longer in the promised land. They're not in the promised land immediately. They find themselves in the desert, and that's a painful place to be. So it's all very difficult to manage this stuff.
Well, it's like a surgical procedure, right? You need to be extremely delicate when you want to affect change in a structure that has withstood, you know, years, decades,
exactly,
centuries, right? And you talk about the Book of Exodus, where Moses takes his people out underneath the tyrannical Pharaoh, and it's like you in that instance, right? You had to rip the Band-Aid off. There was no way that the Pharaoh would release everyone into the desert voluntarily. Like that is not a negotiable position. But that approach doesn't work across the board. And that's what we're seeing, right? If you totally destroy the structure and enter something new, there's going to be a lot of suffering because you're in a chaotic space. And there's that rebuilding phase. So, you know, when we talk about deconstructing patriarchy, you know, there's a level of gentle nudging that's not going to be effective. And that's why a lot of this toxicity still remains. And that's why I give the example of surgery. Sometimes you need to take more of a sledgehammer approach, maybe not disrupt the entire system altogether, but you need to be a little more forceful. And navigating that is extremely challenging, because you always have some group of people who say, you know, destroy it all, eat the rich, you know, all of this, like just totally you know, break down society, what has stood. And then others say, you know, well, maybe we should be more thoughtful, let's be more gentle. That's why these conversations exist.
Exactly. That this is the antidote to, I guess, you know, tyranny. The antidote to tyranny is open conversation. And it's one of the things, I think it was Carl Jung who said that honest conversation is akin to therapy, or something along those lines. So yeah, it's dialogue is incredibly important.
Well, conversation, honest conversation, is that pruning of removing the bad thoughts, removing the ideas that aren't effective, and then cultivating and reorienting your focus with the thoughts that are productive, that are going to make a positive impact to you and your society. So in a way, open and honest conversation, which is rare these days.
Absolutely.
It is hard to find someone to speak with honestly, openly.
Yeah.
Right? And that is why, I'm sorry, I just lost my train of thought.
It's all right.
Go on. That's
a powerful point. No, yeah, open and one of the things, so one of the things that happened in the Soviet Union.
That's why it's therapy.
That's why it's therapy. Okay, yeah. Exactly, yeah.
Because there's an organization process, a self-development, a self-maturation process, which is inherent in therapy. There we go.
Perfect, 100%. You sort of touched on this earlier when you talked about how you have people coming to you saying that their family members have disowned them, so to speak, as a result of their political beliefs. And one of the things that happened during the Soviet Union was that families were ripped apart because I think it was like 3 out of 6 people, maybe not quite that many, maybe 2 out of 6, was a government informer. So no open dialogue could be had, because if you said something that was politically incorrect, meaning in other words, politically incorrect meaning doesn't abide with the party line, you would be ripped out of wherever you were living and you would be thrown in a gulag or whatever. So families in themselves are pretty, you know, you could talk for hours on families and the pathology that lies in families. Is families a lot of, do people have a lot of issues with their families and parents and stuff?
Save it's the beginning of time, Ollie.
Yes, it's the beginning of time. That was a stupid question.
It's always been that way.
Every generation blames on before, don't they? Yes, that's right. Yeah.
That's right. But I mean, you know, I think the one key difference is that the potential to salvage a tense relationship is becoming less and less, because what we're seeing are people kind of digging their heels into their own silos of thought, and they're not willing to even hold an opposing idea, never mind talk about it altogether. So I think that's one of the things I'm seeing, at least clinically, is that people feel like they're not coming to me to help them navigate a difficult conversation. They're coming to me saying they won't talk to me. And they being a family member, brother, uncle, etc.
When you say they're going into their sort of silos, what particularly ideologies or thought patterns is it that are causing that? Is it just political, or is it, are there other things as well?
I'd say politically is probably the most obvious that I'm seeing right now.
Wow.
That was particularly, you know, a few years ago. Yeah. I mean, you know, whether you like it or not, whatever side you were on, I mean, the lockdowns, the mandates that came after COVID sort of, you know, hit the US, it stirred up a lot of emotions. It stirred up a lot of feelings of fear, of anger, of disgust. And, you know, I know a lot of wise people, JP included, talk about how disgust is one of the most powerful emotions, because it will literally take you out of a logical, empathic thought process and put you into one of pure survival.
Yeah.
That can become extremely dangerous.
Absolutely. The, you know, if you're disgusted with something, you want to burn it. But if you're scared of something, yeah, you respect it to some degree, don't you? You place it right above you almost. Right. I understand we've done an hour and you're very busy. So I'm just going to ask the one final little topic that I really wanted to
talk to you
about. What are your opinions on fatherhood and the state of parenthood in 2023 and where we're heading? Given I read a stat that I think by 2030, so the year that I'm 30, so when I'll be looking to have children, 50% of women will be single and childless. So what do you think's going on?
Yeah, that's a big question to finish up on. And all I can say is I'm constantly in a state of humility when it comes to fatherhood. You know, I don't have this whole thing figured out. I doubt anyone does.
No.
Fatherhood is an experience unlike anything else. You undergo this transition where your life is all about you and your responsibilities are, I guess, inherently selfish. It's how can you make yourself better? And then you bring in a child, two, three, however many you have, and you end up prioritizing yourself almost at the bottom. And this is an extremely challenging transition for some people, particularly in a society that sort of cultivates a more narcissistic personality, right?
Absolutely.
So I think a lot of fathers are struggling, and that's not just one of the, that's only one of the reasons why many fathers are struggling with this transition. We talked about, you know, the idea of toxic masculinity just being totally squashed, and that leaves a lot of men thinking, well, what does it mean to be a leader, a father, the head of the household, right? You think about the biblical marriage, a husband is meant to lead and protect. Doesn't mean they're better mm-hmm. or superior to a wife. It's just a different role. It's a vital role, right?
Absolutely.
There's so many factors. And I think the same variables that affect mental health also impact fatherhood to some degree. And I just think, you know, many fathers just want what's best for their children. How you father is largely based on the experiences you had growing up with you and your own father. And for some people, that's extremely positive. For some people, that was traumatizing. I think one thing we're seeing, at least in my generation, I'm a millennial. I'm suspecting you're a Gen Z. Is that right?
Yep.
Yeah. And I suspect we're probably speaking the same language. We are the generation to break that generational trauma. I think we see the world a little differently than, say, our fathers and grandparents did. We want to cultivate a place where our children can thrive, but that path is not obvious. It's not obvious. I mean, you can sit here and theorize how to do it, but in practice, it's extremely challenging. I'm hopeful, right? You asked me if I am, I think you said religious or spiritual. I certainly believe in God. I orient my life towards living a life that is in emulation of Christ, who, really is a figure that people should try to aspire to. Doesn't mean it's possible, right? But I think, I try to orient my life in a way that is going to be productive for the generations that come after me. I'm hopeful that things will get better. I think it's going to be a very dark immediate future, but I also think that the storm will clear, and our children, if we are thoughtful and we move through this tumultuous period with love, with vision and compassion, then I think we can create a space where our children and our grandchildren can thrive.
Perfect. And that is a great place to end. Thank you very much, Chase. This has been a brilliant conversation, and we've gone into places that I'm so glad we went to, and you were an incredible guest. And yes, I will love to have you back on at some point. Have you had a good time? Have I spoken too much?
This was great, Ollie. You were, you asked brilliant. Extremely, really clear questions. It's very clear that a lot of the way you understand human nature is based on a lot of the work that Jordan Peterson has done. JP, yeah. I think one of his gifts is that he can translate really complex ideas into the memes, right? The very smallest point. Like, you talk about Mufasa and what he says to his son Simba in the sky, and like that communicates a massive idea in one sentence. And I think that's JP's gift to humanity, is being able to do that. And I appreciate your interest in his work. I certainly am appreciative of it as well. And it's been brilliant. I really appreciate being with you, Ollie. I'd love to come back and check in sometime soon.
Brilliant.